Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75, 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And so you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. Even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
But you say, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon, which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others, because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back, telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. Man, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, And the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change comes to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 apiece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
She a dude. She just hit you in your face. She a dude. That bitch got nigga. Oh. Beat her motherfucking ass. She drug you, motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass. She a nigga. That nigga hurt himself. You from New State.
Look, the main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments, and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you could do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yee or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns, because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate-made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield? See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that, because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-whack movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavored Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-Civil Rights Movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them. Which is why every single year one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place, there's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087 this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old, and I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you got to own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you.
These are desperate days in New York. With more than 3,500 new cases in the last day alone, medical facilities are critically overstretched. A long line of worried people wait outside this hospital in the borough of Queens just to be tested for the virus.
Almost any scenario that is realistic will overwhelm the capacity of the current healthcare system.
That's why the authorities are drastically stepping up their response. This hospital in Manhattan is setting up a makeshift morgue, getting ready for a wave of deaths.
A morgue? That's creepy. That's creepy.
On a temporary morgue? Oh, God. I don't know. It's awful. It's awful.
Well, I'm scared to be here. That's why I'm obviously wearing a mask.
A determined President Donald Trump insists the battle will be won.
We are waging war on this virus using every financial, scientific, medical, pharmaceutical, and military resource to halt its spread and protect our citizens. I know that we will achieve victory and quickly return to the path of exceptional health, safety, and prosperity for all of our citizens.
Other emergency measures include this 1,000-bed U.S. Navy hospital ship, due to arrive in New York Harbor on Monday to ease the pressure on the city's own hospitals. Normally packed, Times Square is now eerily deserted, with no tourists in town and New Yorkers heeding a government ban on working and socializing in public. A city already in fear knows that the worst is still to come.
Let's check out the situation then in the U.S. with DW correspondent Oliver Sallet in Washington. Welcome, Oliver. Why is President Trump so confident this crisis will be resolved soon?
Well, Phil, I'm not even sure he is that confident, but what he's really trying to do here is to sell hope and optimism to the American public, of course, and also to the American voters, because he knows that his re-election is at stake. And, you know, you have millions of Americans who feel very much insecure at this time, are scared, of course, of the current situation of unemployment, of the spreading virus, the pandemic. And so every day President Trump delivers this press conference in the White House press briefing room that, by the way, he hardly ever used in his presidency, and that he's now turned into something like his campaign rally, if you will, with the major message being always like, it's all going to be good, it's all going to be okay, we're going to go back to work soon, and the stock markets will go back up again. That's another very important aspect, of course, here in the United States. So experts and his own health experts in the White House see that differently, but his voters like it. And you can see that in the job approval rate of President Trump. That's as high as it has never been in his presidency.
And the U.S., like the rest of the world, is facing an economic crisis. Unemployment claims that last week were the highest recorded ever.
Yeah, that's right. And we're now in a situation where more than 3 million Americans filed unemployment, but there are some respected economists who believe that this is not just the beginning, that this number could go up to 46 million within this crisis. So the worst is certainly yet to come, not only with regards to the pandemic, but also with regards to the economic fallout of the pandemic. And that's, again, very threatening for Trump's re-election bid, because he's always made the case that this is the most successful economy and the most successful stock market of all times. This is basically, essentially, Trump's take and why he should be re-elected. But this all is turning into the exactly opposite.
Except that they have pumped an unprecedented $2.2 trillion into the economy. Well, this is the hope anyway, this rescue package that cleared the Senate and is expected to be voted on in the House on Friday. Is this going to be enough to ease the strain, not just on the health system, but on the whole of the U.S. economy?
Well, right. It's again an unprecedented sum, money that is urgently needed, and as you say, it's mostly needed as a kind of emergency relief, so to compensate people and businesses that are suffering from the situation right now, from the lockdowns across many economic centers in the United States. But if you look at the health system, that in particular in the epicenter in New York, that many health workers there describe as catastrophic, where fridge trucks are used right now to store the bodies of deceased patients in the hospitals, well, then money, of course, is necessary and would help, but only if the necessary material is available. And New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo desperately is calling for 40,000 ventilators, for instance. He's also stressing that the healthcare system is running out of supplies very soon. So money is certainly not the only problem here. It's also the fact that the material is not available on the market.
Oliver Sallet in Washington, thank you. Well, half of the world's more than 500,000 confirmed coronavirus cases are here in Europe. So this crisis is likely to hit the bloc harder than the previous economic and migration crises. The European Central Bank's already announced unprecedented action to support EU members and businesses, but member states can't agree on how to distribute the financial burden, and this is resurrecting old fault lines between North and South.
Protective gloves, now a regular feature in the European Parliament. The assembly is largely empty. MEPs who do attend are taking extra precautions. On the agenda, forging a common EU response to the coronavirus crisis.
When Europe really needed an all-for-one spirit, too many initially gave an only-for-me response. And when Europe really needed to prove that this is not only a fair weather union, too many initially refused to share their umbrella.
An umbrella some EU members remain reluctant to share. That includes von der Leyen's home country, Germany, even as the pandemic storm intensifies across the bloc. Thursday's six-hour video conference with the EU's 27 national leaders ended without agreement on just how unified the economic response should be, especially when it comes to sharing debt across the Eurozone.
We reject communal debt. This is an old system that has not been used in the past.
The countries hardest hit by the pandemic so far, Italy, France, and Spain, are among nine EU countries in favor of so-called corona bonds. Opponents, including the Netherlands and Finland, prefer the European Stability Mechanism, set up in 2012 to respond to the euro crisis. The ESM can lend money to members in trouble, but with strings attached. Now Eurozone finance ministers have 2 weeks to figure out the details, a long time in the life of the rapidly spreading virus.
Let's go to Georg Matthes. He's following developments for us in Brussels. Georg, I mean, we had a pretty strong condemnation there today. Where does Ursula von der Leyen, where does she see this lack of solidarity now?
Let me give you two examples, Brent. One is the export of those essential masks
but also protective gear for doctors. And that export did not take place. Italy, for instance, needed those masks, and they did not get them from a fellow EU member state, but in the end they got them from China. Another example is the closure of national borders at a time of crisis, creating traffic jams, risking the flow, the frequent flow of goods in the internal market. And that is why Ursula von der Leyen has said, let's coordinate all of this, let's make a European stockpile, let's also make sure we close the external borders so that internal borders can remain open.
Okay, those are her suggestions. What came out of the video conference today? Were there any solutions that were offered?
It looks like we're having a row here over the financial means to help in the corona crisis. In other words, help the economy. There's a draft a conclusion of this virtual summit, and in it it says the European Stability Mechanism should be used and finance ministers should look into that. There is, however, no mentioning of so-called corona bonds or mutual bonds in the EU, because behind the scenes already the Netherlands, but also Germany, said they do not want these bonds. They still believe that nations in Europe can get debt from the debt market, so they are still stable, and so those means are not necessary yet. And the Italian prime minister, in the meantime, has already said he has rejected those draft conclusions, and he has given the EU 10 days to come up with an adequate plan how to financially secure the future of Europe.
Yeah, it seems like we're going from one crisis to the next at the moment. Georg Mathis on the story for us in Brussels. Georg, thank you.
Well, let's take a look at some more of the latest developments in the coronavirus pandemic. 3 months into the outbreak, and the total number of confirmed cases has passed 500,000. And the death toll is more than 24,000. France has reported the fifth highest number of COVID-19 deaths, and its death toll is still climbing. It's jumped by a quarter in just one day. And German company Bosch says it has developed a coronavirus test for use in medical facilities that delivers results in 2.5 hours, twice as fast as other tests. Well, the virus poses a particular danger to people living in Greece's overcrowded migrant camps. On Lesbos and on other Greek islands, tens of thousands are packed together in squalid conditions with little health care. An outbreak could be devastating.
Lesbos, a few days ago, migrants sew face masks, offering protection to others in the camps here as well as new arrivals. Now, though, the island is in lockdown. Built to house 3,000, 20,000 people live in this camp. Now it's cut off from the outside world. Peter Cesar from Doctors Without Borders says his organisation has long been calling for an evacuation, and now things are much worse.
They know they are trapped, and they know that there are no measures taken by the authorities to protect them against the virus. And that's another issue. So there is a real threat that this will be a medical and a humanitarian catastrophe. But there's also the fear that is going on, and we might see a lot of panic.
Hygiene is a big problem here, and with social distancing virtually impossible, any infection would spread extremely rapidly. There are just 6 intensive care beds in the island's main town. The very weak and sick, including chronically ill children, would need to be transported to the mainland. Germany's SPD party has appealed for action. Germany and some other European nations have offered to start by taking in around 1,500 people, mainly unaccompanied or sick children. It's just an initial step, and it now needs to happen very quickly. The European Commission is responsible for coordinating it all. An evacuation would be quick to organise, says migration expert Gerald Knaus. There are 800,000 beds in hotels in Greece, with only around 7,000 in use. 10,000 people on the islands could be accommodated on the mainland. The International Organization for Migration is now building temporary, safer camps to move people to. Yet so far, there's been no evacuation. It's time for European solidarity, says Knaus. Those with refugee status living on the mainland could be taken in by other EU countries, with all the accompanying healthcare protection they offer. MEP Eric Marquardt has been on Lesbos for several weeks. He's been documenting the inhumane conditions of the camps. The EU Commission must coordinate the quick evacuation of people from refugee camps to individual member countries, and we must work out how to ensure that hygiene and medical standards are adhered to. The EU Commission says it hopes that countries will be able to begin taking in children within the next few weeks.
Well, South Africa has confirmed its first two coronavirus deaths as the number of confirmed cases rises to more than 1,000. The news comes at the start of a three-week nationwide lockdown to stop the spread of the virus. The military has been deployed to help enforce measures that include restrictions on people leaving their homes for anything but essential trips. Alcohol sales and dog walking have also been banned. DW Africa correspondent Adrian Creech joins us from Cape Town. Welcome, Adrian. What's it like there on day one of this lockdown?
Well, Phil, you can see it behind me. It is empty. I'm on normally one of the busiest streets in the center of Cape Town on Long Street, and there's almost nobody here. Everybody is forced to stay at home, as the sign says right behind me. This is the order for the next 3 weeks, and it will be enforced according to the president and his ministers. Nobody is allowed to leave the houses, only for essential services. If you go to a supermarket, for example, but you're not allowed, not even alone, to walk around, to go for jogging, to walk your dog. This is all forbidden. So it's three very tough weeks ahead for South Africa, but it is a necessary step, the president says. Looking at the numbers, how they're growing, they have reached more than 1,000 corona cases today.
So following on from those numbers, how is the country's healthcare infrastructure coping?
Well, at the moment, it is still coping rather well, but this is at the moment. The reason why President Cyril Ramaphosa took the decision was quite clear. He knew that the health system is likely to collapse if the numbers continue to grow the way they have grown in the past days and weeks. 80% of South Africa's mainly poor population is catered for by the public health sector, and it's already now overwhelmed in the townships where millions of South Africans are living in very bad conditions. Access to healthcare is a massive problem, and it's going to be a worse problem in the weeks to come. Experts predict that the number of cases will still continue to grow for at least 2 weeks, and then hopefully we will be seeing a decline, and that hopefully will give the health sector a chance to recover and not be totally overwhelmed.
And all this in a country that was already in recession with an unemployment rate of 29%. What's being done to lessen the economic impact of this crisis?
Absolutely, Phil. More than every second young South African is already unemployed now, and it looks very bad for the future of the country, depending how this lockdown will work or not work. Many people here have the feeling with the support of the government, they came up with a number of packages to support small businesses. The economy could survive for the 3 weeks, but it is not clear if maybe it could be extended in the future after the 3 weeks. It is not successful. Nobody knows how things develop afterwards. Will tourists really come back right away? Remember, the country heavily relies on tourism, which brings a lot of income, and at the moment that sector is basically dead. Hotels shut down, restaurants are shut down, so the outlook is not very positive at the moment, but South Africans still remain optimistic that things will get back to normal after this lockdown.
Thank you for that. Adrian Creech in Cape Town.
Okay, today's podcast is titled Pandemic Village, and we've got a very important Airbnb conference call in a few, but let me try to straighten out some of these technical difficulties. We had a guest that called and dropped twice, so let's see if we can get things straightened out.